see you. And for those of you that are visiting, we're glad you're here. We hope we make you feel welcome and you'll want to be back with us often. And I would ask you, if you would, to please locate a visitor's card. It's probably just in front of you on the back of the pew. And please fill that out. And you can just hand it to me on the way out if you've not already done that. But we're glad you're here. This morning we're going to continue to look at our focus for this quarter of our theme. Our theme is Build an Ark. It's taken from the words of a song that was written, I don't know, about 40 years ago. But it's the idea of, like Noah, building an ark and escaping what's going on in the world. And our theme verse, of course, is from Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7. And that is that Noah did build that ark for the salvation of his house. And by doing so, he separated and, in return, condemned the world, people who were not willing to do that. And so this morning we're going to talk about the struggle that there is for discipline, which we're focusing on this quarter. Because to build an ark takes discipline. If you're going to build anything like that, a huge structure, is what Noah was building in his day, a 100-year project. And if you're going to do something like that, it's going to take discipline. It's going to take that dedication, that commitment, and all of those terms like that that we employ to describe what discipline is. It's going to take teaching. It's going to take applying what you know is right. All of that sort of thing. And so this morning, we're going to talk about the struggle or the battle for discipline. Let me begin with an observation about Noah. Turn back with me, if you will, to Genesis chapter 6. And this is where God intervened in a world of unrighteous people. A world that is described by God as being filled with violence. A world that was corrupt. A world in which everyone, by God's own description, had separated themselves from Him. They were living lives that were not right. And you know, one wonders at the real struggle Noah had to put up with daily in order to be righteous in his generation. I want you to focus for a moment on that idea. Just kind of go back with me, try to put yourself, and in ways it's not possible, but try to put yourself in the shoes of Noah, a man who looks around him and literally, we sometimes say, you know, everybody does so and so, the whole world is doing such and such. In his day, that was literally the truth. Everyone was away from God but himself. Try to imagine what it would be like if God has looked down on the world and has seen you, and you garner God's favor. You alone are approved of by God. You alone are favored by God in the midst of a whole world who is not. A world that is described by God, a people who, if you look at verse 5, whose wickedness was great in the earth. And every imagination of the thoughts of his heart, that is of every person, was only evil continually. I mean, words are, adjectives and adverbs are just piled up in that verse to describe for us how bad things were. And you live in that world. Every family member you know, every friend you have, every person you perhaps interact with business-wise, every person that you call a friend is that wicked, that bad. And you alone are living right. What would it be like? What kind of struggle would you have to go through? What kind of antagonism would there be from other people to lead this old, outdated notion of being right with what? A God up there in the sky? And live your life because it's the only one, Noah, you have. Do what we do. Live like we live. Be like we are. What kind of daily struggle would it be? And you know, you compound that with the fact that once God calls him, now he's got to preach about this God, if he hasn't been already. He's got to tell others that not only is there really this God up there, but he is really going to condemn the world, and that means you're going to die if you don't come to God. going to destroy the world by water, and in order for you to escape, you need to build this great big boat. Because it's going to rain. And chances are great, if you read the Bible and interpret it the way most people do, it has never rained up to that point. You would be laughed to ridicule. People would scorn what you believe. And we know that his success rate, I mean, we might look at it in one sense and say it was very high. Because he saved his wife and his sons and their wives. But you might also look at it that in 100 years of preaching, nobody else was converted. And he went right on day after day after day after day for 100 years preaching and building that ark. What kind of struggle would you have to go through? What kind of mental toll would it take? Emotional strain would it be? But you know, he's not the only person that the Bible describes like that. Go with me to 2 Peter chapter 5, chapter 2, and look down when it describes Noah in his day, who was that preacher of righteousness, and then gives us an example of Lot. And it's interesting what it says here. I'm going to read 2 Peter 2 and go down with me to verse 07. And he says, he delivered just or righteous Lot, notice. And then the King James says, vexed with the filthy conversation or manner of life of the wicked people. For that righteous man, verse 8, dwelling among them, living among them, and I want you to focus on that, in seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. Now, it's interesting that two different words, and perhaps in another translation besides the King James, you have this translated differently. The King James uses vexed, but they're two different words. But I want you to look at the words. Because here is a righteous man, Lot, and he is living in the city of Sodom. The Bible tells us that in the book of Genesis. And in fact, he has lived there long enough and become well known enough that he is even one of the rulers of the city. He's like one of the elders. He sits in the gate, so to speak. And yet, here is Lot living a righteous life, doing what God tells him to do, obeying God in the midst of a metropolis for their day, a big city filled with people who are as wicked as they can be. And so the Bible tells us, and you'll notice up here the two terms that I put, the Bible tells us he was oppressed. And he's oppressed by their filthiness, their wicked deeds. You know that word, oppressed there, that first word translated vexed, it's something that wears on you or wears you down. It's used elsewhere in writing. The Greek word is for something that erodes, you know, like soil or beaches being eroded. And the idea is that the filthiness that was all around him just wore on him. And it wore him down. And the idea is it just vexed him in that sense that it was wearing at him every day. Now, you ever felt like that? You ever felt like you get up in the morning, and perhaps, and I know a number of you do this, you get up in the morning, you pray, you perhaps read your Bible, maybe some of you are engaged in the writing of Scripture, and you start your day off with God. And yet you go out, and as soon as you walk out the door, or even if you turn on the radio or television or computer before you walk out the door, immediately the filth comes. No matter. I don't care if you're trying to look at the Weather Channel to see if you need an umbrella today, or if you're looking at the news before you go out, or you turn on the computer real quick to get your email. I don't care what it is, the filth just slams you. And you go out into the world, and school, work, friends, subway, bus, carpool, doesn't matter. The filthiness. It wears. You get tired. And sometimes you've made a decision, I am going to be as righteous as I can be today. I mean, man, I am determined to do everything like God wants me to do. And it seems that when you make that commitment, and I'm talking about just today, you make that commitment, the worse it is. Lot was vexed. But the Bible goes on to tell us in the next verse, he was vexed, and it uses a term for tormented or even tortured. Their unlawful deeds brought him daily pain. It didn't just wear on him, it hurt him. It was something that he felt, you see. It's something he had to live with day by day. And that's the way the Bible is describing it. Now, I think that's true of all righteous people. In fact, I think if the filthiness of the world isn't wearing on you, you've just become callous to it. And if it isn't bringing you pain by seeing what everybody is doing, then you just spiritually don't care anymore. I mean, we have a Lord's Supper on Sunday morning. We emphasize, and Wes did, that Jesus gave his life for all these people and for me. All these people living in all this filth and for me. All these people that are doing all these things without caring or perhaps even realizing that they're going to hell. When you look around and you see friends and family, like Noah, like Lot, and they're doing the same thing, it hurts. And maybe sometimes it wears on you to the point that you just start giving. You start relinquishing. You start letting down your guard. You just basically throw your hands up sometimes and say, what's the use? What's the point? When we look at people like this, I want you to understand these stories in the Bible are real people. And they're like you, and they felt, what you feel, and they lived the lives you live, and they went through the things you go through. And yet, the Bible is telling us that these people stuck it out. It's a battle, and you have to do battle. You have to fight to be a disciplined individual, especially in a world that cares nothing for that discipline. It's a battle, it's a struggle, and it takes considerable discipline to overcome the battle, to overcome the fight, if you will, to overcome the wickedness, the filth that is in the world. And it takes a dedicated commitment. I mean a real dedicated commitment to the battle for it. We have a generation of people, and when I wrote that, I first wrote that, and then I said, no, let's be honest. Let's go back. So I stuck the parentheses in there. Maybe several generations. Certainly all of my life. And I would venture to say to an extent, unless you are very old and remember a really different time that my grandmother used to talk about. You know, maybe ideally so, but she used to talk about it. But we have generations of undisciplined people. But I mean, when you look around you and you see the world and the situation that people are in, I mean, it's characterized by certain things. And I'm going to throw up here not every example, but a few examples of things that tell us, characteristics within people at large. Okay? This may not be true of you. You may be the exceptional individual. You may be the Noah, the Lot. But for most people, this is true. One of them is time. Just think about it for a moment. And the responsible use of our time. Now I want you to go back in history with me to a time most of you certainly cannot remember. When if you were going to wash clothes, do laundry, you took all day. Okay? I mean, if it was wash day or you were doing the laundry, you got up early in the morning, you began to boil the water, you wash the clothes, which took the majority of the day. You had to wring each garment out by hand. You had to hang it up. You had to collect it, etc., etc. It was an all-day affair. If you were going to have bread today, you baked it, you know. Or you went down to, you know, a place, you walked down to a place and bought it baked. But my point is, and you see where I'm going, everything that was just a basic little part of life used to take a lot of time. Starbucks, or I run out to the store 15 minutes to get some bread, come back. I want to do my laundry, and I don't do my laundry, but if I wanted to do my laundry, I'd have to run down the stairs, throw it in the washing machine, come back up, do whatever it is I wanted to do. But that's the point, isn't it? I've been freed up to have a lot of time. But how do people spend their time? You know what's descriptive of people that live in this generation, or maybe we'd say at this time right now in America, what's descriptive of people? We never have enough time. If I went around and polled each one of you before this sermon and I said, man, do you have enough time? Or does it seem like you never have enough time? How many of you would have said, man, it seems like I never have enough time? We never have enough of it. And certainly not for the things that really matter. I can't tell you the countless thousands of people, members of the church, that I've said to over the last 40 years, we'd love to have you coming on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. Or Wednesday night to Bible study. And you know what the number one reason given to me for why people cannot come on a Sunday afternoon, why they cannot come on a Wednesday night, or why right now the biggest movement trend in America right now is throw away the second service on Sunday and scale it back to one. You know the number one reason? We don't have enough time. You got more time than any human beings ever had in history. Ever had. And you don't have enough time. And you don't have enough time for the things that matter. You don't have enough time to worship God. You don't have enough time to learn the Bible. Members of the church are more ignorant of what's in this book than I think they ever have been. You don't have enough time to pray. You don't have enough time to even think about God. And most people don't even have enough time for their own families. What's wrong with that picture? We don't have enough time. I'll tell you something else. Our finances. Now, I know there are people in this room, and you are in control of your finances. But that's not true of most people. When you look at most people, most people are extremely undisciplined when it comes to their finances. I mean, the ability to handle responsibilities, even of just getting a job and, you know, producing for yourself, living according to what you make, etc., it comes at a later and later time. And I'm not against parents helping their children. I think you ought to. I think you are there to give your kids the boost they need in life. I believe in that. But at the same time, I believe there comes a time when a person ought to, now you don't need to do it like I did, walk out, you know, at 16 and leave home. But I think there comes a time when you need to be able to live on your own. I'm in conversations with my father right now. And I'm not going to go into the Shaggy Dog story, but my father worked hard all his life. And he built up a savings account, you know, to pad his retirement and his Social Security, tens of thousands of dollars, and it's gone. And you know why it's gone? Because certain people won't take the responsibility at a later and later and later, or never, and have bled him dry. He's a good-hearted guy. But I wish at some point to adult children, he had said, enough. It's time for you to take responsibility. It's out of control. And you know, it's nationally out of control. You go into New York or you turn on the TV and you can see the debt counter and it just spins, right? It's out of control. Nationally. Individually. Debt mounts. People have easier access to credit cards. Some of you remember. Do you remember together with me when it was hard to get a credit card? I really was. Younger people laughed at that. I mean, man, we had to work at being able to get the privilege of having a credit card. But not anymore. And people don't have a credit card. They have 10 and 12 and 15 maxed out. They have debt that they look at and say, I can never pay, so I need the government to pay it for me. So I'll be freed up to have some more. And I know that's a cynical view, but you also know that it's pretty close to the truth. We're more affluent now. What do I mean by that? We have more luxuries now. We have more things now than any generation of people ever had in their lives. And we're less secure than any of them ever were. We don't know what we're going to do in the future because we don't know who is going to help us out. What's wrong with that picture? Our relationships. Undisciplined people. And when it comes to relationships are totally unstable. The instruction for how to have a relationship, what to do in one, how to make it successful, how to start it, how to maintain it, it comes from the street. It comes from looking around you. You measure the success of your relationship by comparing it to other people. And parents, generally speaking, are completely uninvolved. They're not the role models they once were. The children ridicule them. Younger people look at them as either outdated notions or ridiculous expectations. Even our spiritual relationship with God. We want it. We've talked about that. We need it. And yet it remains a constant struggle. I mean, I'm having to struggle, fight, to maintain just a basic relationship with God. Much less with my family or my friends. What's wrong with that picture? We live in a time where people are undisciplined. It's an undisciplined approach to life and every facet of it. And beyond time, finances, relationships, even spiritual ones, we can put a lot of things, other things up here that would characterize how undisciplined we are. Go back to the passage Marvin read for us. Go back to Psalm 140 for a moment. I was kind of meditating on this passage this week, and I was looking really for a passage that I wanted to say what I'm trying to say. And I knew God could say it much better, so I learned a passage that would do that. And I want you to listen again to this. When the psalmist says, Psalm 140 and down in verse 6, I said to the Lord, notice this, I said to the Lord, you are my God. I wonder how many people really think about that and in their prayer say, you know, you're my God and I'm your child. And started with that. But listen to what he says. Hear the voice of my supplications, O Lord. O God, the Lord, the strength of my salvation. I think David realizes that salvation comes at a cost. That to be right with God is a fight, a battle. And that the strength, just like all the way back to the bear and the lion and the giant, the battle is the Lord's. And the strength is going to come from Him. You have, notice this, covered my head in the day of battle. And that's what I was looking for. Because the idea is, when I go out and do battle, and I know I have to, it's a battle if I'm going to be disciplined. I've got to have somebody at my back. I've got to have someone who's protecting me when I don't or I can't. And that someone is God. I'm not alone in this. And David knew that. You know, you go out to fight an enemy that's much stronger, more powerful than you, and can kill you easily, then you need God's strength. He knew that. You've covered my head. Notice verse 8. Grant me, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. Or grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. And he says, further not his wicked device, lest they exalt themselves. And I think this is what he's getting at. I go back to Noah. I go back to Lot and I wonder if they prayed this kind of thing. They're trying to fight you. They're trying to defeat you. They're trying to get you to leave God and come over to their side. Because to have just one person in your face doing right when you're doing wrong, I mean, it grinds at you. It's like a thorn in your side and you can't stand it. So they're really pulling at you, and they want you to come to that side. And what David is saying is, God, Don't let that happen. Don't grant them success. You are my God. I am your child. You are the one that's got me covered in this battle. You be there for me and don't let them win. I think that's what he's saying. If you're going to build an ark, and that's what we're talking about figuratively here. If you're going to build an ark, and you know, Noah had a 100-year project to build a gigantic boat. But if you've got a 100-year project to build a successful life that will save you and others, if you're going to build an ark to escape the undisciplined, unrighteous life that leads to destruction, the kind of life we just described, if you're going to do that, it's going to take a committed battle. You're going to have to fight. You can't just, as you know, they used to say down south, you can't just hit a lick at a snake. You know, you get a poisonous snake, you can't hit a lick at it, can you, Yvonne? You've got to kill that thing, or it's coming after you. You can't just hit a lick at religion. You can't just every once in a while duck into a church building and go through a worship service and figure that you've protected yourself enough. You're fighting the battle. That's not fighting the battle. If it's doing anything, just like hitting a lick at a snake, you can make it mad. And then you can hit a lick at religion and you can make, you know, a lot of forces out there mad. No, it takes a committed battle. The battle for discipline is not with other people. You see, other people are going to be used. The first thing they know is with Satan. And that's true. It is with Satan. But if you'll turn over to Ephesians chapter 6 and look at that passage with me quickly, you'll see that Paul is saying it really doesn't start there. That's not the battle. The battle goes beyond that. So read this together with me in verse 12. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in the high places. Now you look at that and you say, okay, so my battle is with Satan and demons. And that's right. But let's go a little bit deeper with that. Turn over with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Because the battle is not just with the forces of hell. The battle is what's going on inside you. And when you look at 2 Corinthians 10, notice down in verse 3, though we walk in the flesh, notice that, we don't war after the flesh. That's what I'd like to think. I'd like to think, and there are plenty of people in the world who would like to think, if I could just, number one, close myself off from bad people. Now, how do you do that? You know, I mean, you might go to an Amish-type community. Or you might join some cult. But we all know the failures that exist in those as well. So how do you really do that? Well, sometimes I say, okay, well, if I can just learn how to fight Satan because it's his fault. Well, it is. But the battle is not out there somewhere. Battle is inside me. The war is inside me. I want you to notice what Paul goes on to say here in this passage. And I'll just touch on some verses. I'd like for you to go home and meditate on this chapter. But just touch on some things he says here. First of all, it takes the armor of God. Now I'll reflect back on Ephesians 6 for this. Because he tells you to do the battle. The weapons, the warfare of warfare, the armor, the weapon, meaning the Bible, he describes aptly in Ephesians 6. But it takes that. It takes the armor and weapon of God. But stop for a moment and think about the things that are listed in that well-known passage. The preparation of the gospel. It's not just grabbing a Bible and holding it up like a crucifix to a vampire. That's not going to do it. I've got to know what's in here. It's got to be inside here. That's how I do battle. And I fortify myself with my faith and my salvation and, you know, all of those things he describes as the helmet, etc. That's the armor. That's the weapon of God to bring down those, notice in verse 4, those strongholds. When I look at that passage, in verse 4, those strongholds. When I used to do battling and fighting, you knew where was a stronghold. You strategically knew where you could go somewhere and be fortified. That's what this word is. You knew where you would be protected. And the idea was that some place was so strong it couldn't be penetrated. Now, Paul uses it negatively here. Because what he's getting at, if you'll notice in verse 4, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They are mighty through God to the casting down or pulling down of strongholds. So I ask you this. If we're doing battle, and Satan or the world or however you want to picture it, if they've got a hold on you, if they've got a strong hold on you, where is it? And I think we all know it. I think we know, and I think we could even sit down and write out a list. If it wasn't for this place, this person, this thing, and this, and maybe the list goes on a little further, I could be right with God. And if I'm honest with myself, and I admit it, there are so many things in my life that are right. But there's this, and maybe this, and this. And it's got such a strong hold on me, and maybe has for years, that I am not what I want to be. Notice as he goes on here. In verse 5, he talks about casting down. Notice the word, imaginations. You know what that word means? And maybe you have a translation that hits at this. It's a word that means reasoning. We call it sometimes rationalizing. But I've got this and this and this. Why is it I keep doing this and this and this? Why is it this and this and this has such a strong hold on me? And I'll tell you why. Because I reason that it must be so. I'm the one that makes the argument. How crazy is that? It's destroying my life. It's stealing my soul. And I make reasons. I give them. I argue with me as to why it should remain there. Casting those things down and bringing them into captivity. Like Noah had to. The imaginations of the thoughts of people's hearts. Notice verse 7. Very interesting. Do you look on things after the outward appearance? Now I want you to stop and think about that for a moment. I might turn to that verse and I might talk about how we might have prejudice and all of this kind of looking at people and the color of their skin. I don't think he's talking about that. Not here. Do you look on things after the outward appearance? Oh, maybe he's referencing himself, and you'll see plenty of times in this passage when he'll talk about how they view him as weak and all of this kind of thing, his outward appearance. But I think it goes deeper than that. Let's read it together. Do you look on things after the outward appearance? If any man trusts to himself that he is Christ. Now this is what Paul is arguing. So what are you looking at to give you confidence that you belong to Christ? Let him of himself think this again, that as he is Christ, even so are we Christ. I believe what Paul is saying is this. If I belong to Christ, and I think he believes he does. If I am Christ, if I belong to him, why do I belong to him? Could it be because I've done the very thing I'm telling you people that you need to do? That you need to pull those strongholds down. That you need to cast down that rationale. Quit giving in to those things and live for God. And I believe that's what he's saying. He goes on to say in verse 8, and read it with me. For though I should boast somewhat more of our authority, and he speaks of the apostles' authority, which the Lord has given us, notice, for edification. And not for your destruction. I should not be ashamed. Think about it. Michael White, Wes Gossett, others get up here in the pulpit and they preach. And somebody kind of summarizes it all and says, this is what you do. You tell me not to live my life. And you tell me, live like understand how people live like this. Now, that's a gross summary, but you know, that's really the way people look at it. It's the way I look at it. It's what I said to Dale. A little bit different words, but that's what I said. Basically, what I said to Dale is that's not happening. I'm holding on. And I had strongholds. I had things that had a strong hold on me. Certain sins I wanted to keep committing. Certain feelings like intense hatred that I meant to hold on to. They deserved it. Things like that. Paul said, you know, I could boast of the fact that I'm an apostle and I have the right to tell you what to do, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask you to look at me personally. I'm going to ask that you look at me and that you see someone who belongs to Jesus Christ, someone who let go of strongholds. And I'm going to say to you, as a brother or sister in Christ, if you're going to live a Christian life, that's what you're going to have to do. One final point. In verses 12 through 18, we looked at this last week. I won't spend much time on it. Remember again how he says in verse 12, we dare not make ourselves of the people who compare themselves with other people, measure themselves by other people, because I take you back to where we were on the previous slide. Is that really where you want to be? The world, and don't misunderstand, because I'm part of it, okay? The world is not successful. Our generation, with its lack of responsibility, with its undisciplined approach to time, to finances, to relationships, even to the relationship with God, it ain't working. It's just not. It's not working any better than it did in Noah's day when God said, I've had enough. That's enough. And yeah, there are individuals. I believe there are individuals in this room who have separated themselves like Noah and whom God looks down on with favor. I believe that. But I'm just talking about the whole world we live in, and if we're not careful, that influences even us. Because like Lot, I don't know about you, but I do know me, it wears on me. And I know that sometimes it even tortures or torments me. And I get tired of it. And yet you have to renew the fight and say, no, I know the life I have to live because I know what's coming. We'll close with that. We'll come back and pick this up. The next two lessons are very integrated together with this one, so I'm going to leave right there. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, you've never made that commitment, you don't live that life, and you know that. You say, you know, you described it a minute ago. What you're preaching to me is give up my life. And I'm really not. I am preaching a different approach to life. An approach to life that says, let me accept that God knows what He's talking about and commit myself to living like that and trusting Him that it has the promise of this life and the world to come. You need to make that commitment. You believe in Jesus and you confess that He is the Son of God. You're willing to change your life this morning. You'll be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. Or if you've done that and you want to make that commitment again, some people call it rededicating their lives. Won't you please come while we stand?